from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Violent crime is down, way down. Nationally, the violent crime rate hasn't been this low in 40 years. In 2010, murder, rape, aggravated assault, even property crimes all declined nationwide from the previous year. And the same trends can be seen in California, where 2010 marked the lowest homicide rate since 1966. And the baffling thing is, no one's completely sure why. In the hour ahead, we'll take a closer look at the numbers and the story behind them. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in this morning for Michael Krasny. New crime statistics are out this week, and the numbers may surprise you. Violent crime is down nationwide, way down. In itself, that's not necessarily startling. Crime rates have fallen for much of the past 20 years. But it's intriguing that the drop would continue during tough economic times. Even property crimes have continued to drop. Nationwide, violent crime is now at its lowest rate in 40 years. In California, the homicide rate, the lowest in 46 years. And according to a Brookings Institution report out yesterday, crime is falling even where you might not expect it to fall, including in the inner city. So in this hour forum, we're going to try to get beyond those numbers some and talk about why crime is falling and where the biggest challenges in law enforcement remain. Joining us to start us out this morning, Barry Crisberg. He is Research and Policy Director for the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Law and Social Policy. Mr. Crisberg, good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us as well is Ronald Davis. He's Chief of Police for the City of East Palo Alto. Chief Davis, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. And Al Bloomstein joins us as well. He's a criminologist in Hines College. That's with Carnegie Mellon University and co-author of the book Crime Drop in America. Mr. Bloomstein, thanks for being with us as well.
Glad to be here.
And in a while, we'll also be joined by Chris Magnus, Chief of Police for Richmond, California. Well, let's begin by just looking at some of the numbers, and then we'll get to some of the reasons why those numbers might be what they are. But Barry Crisberg first, just I would be curious to get your sort of just general reaction when you see these numbers that I was citing, that violent crime is down to its, you know, lowest rate in 40 years, robberies down 10%, murder down 4.4 just from last year, so forth and so on. When you see these, do you go, wow, that's something? Or do you go, well, of course. What's the sort of nature of your response to those basic statistics?
My response has been – wow, because 20 years ago, there were some predicting a huge crime increase. And I think a few of us felt that those predictions were overblown. But I don't think anybody, well, very few in criminology were ready to predict a steady decline of the magnitude that we've seen. It's certainly good news in terms of the society and I think creates a lot of opportunities to look forward in terms of how we ought to invest public resources.
We'll get to that important question in a little bit. Is it significant that things have dropped, that murder, for example, has dropped at one level from last year, 4.4% nationally, robberies down twice as much, 9.5%? Do you look at any particular kind of crime dropping as being more significant than another?
Well, first of all, the crime drops that occur in things like in violent crimes, especially homicide, I think we view that as very reliable because, you know, other crime statistics could be subject to reporting. Mm-hmm. For example, drug offenses. Depending upon enforcement patterns, you could increase drug crimes, you could decrease them. There are certain kinds of especially property crimes that are sort of dependent upon economic factors. But homicides are pretty clear.
Murder gets reported.
Right.
I mean, yeah.
As do armed robberies and these kinds of things.
Chief Davis, let me bring you in from East Palo Alto because the numbers in East Palo Alto are really pretty stunning. Over the last 5 years, a 73% drop in homicide, 30% drop in rape, a 22% drop in assault. Do you have the same kind of reaction that Barry Crisberg does? Wow.
Well, in part, being in law enforcement for the last 27 years, I was there when people were making that prediction. And if you look back about that time period, I mean, we were still, I think, right at the beginning or right in the middle, Barry, you remember, in the crack epidemic. And so our homicide rates, for example, in 1992, if you look around, whether it's East Palo Alto or Oakland, at that time I was in Oakland, that the homicide rates were peaking. I mean, they were hitting all-time highs. And many of us thought, we just can't sustain this. So as the drug of choice, for lack of a better phrase, changed, we saw some of the violence dropping. But at the same time, I'm with Barry, I do have a wow factor because I think many predicted more recently that with an economic downturn, with downsizing of law enforcement, that would cause crime to go up. I do agree with Barry about how you track crime. So, for example, the number, it is not to minimize any crime, but the number that I really focus on, for example, that same 5 years you mentioned, 73% reduction in homicides, but I really focus on a 67% reduction in shootings. Because in many cases, you can have your homicide rate go down, but your shootings are still up, and then the reduction may be more based on the caliber of weapon used, the type of shooting from how far away, and actually trauma centers. How good is your trauma center in saving lives? And so what I look at is how many times people actually pull the trigger. And to see whether or not violence is going down or how many times you do the robberies, because even the murder rate can be misleading if other violence is going up. You have to really take a look at why the murder rate itself is going down.
Chief Ronald Davis, Chief of Police in the city of East Palo Alto. Alfred Bloomstein joins us as well, criminologist at Carnegie Mellon University, co-author of Crime Drop in America. Same question, Mr. Bloomstein. What jumps out at you at the numbers that are out this week?
They certainly come out as a surprise, but the big surprise occurred a year ago. We had about an 8% drop in murder and in robbery, which are the two crimes I focus on, because they're well-measured, well-defined, and reasonably well-reported. So we had an 8% drop last year, and 4.5% in murder now, and 9.5% in robbery. So the big shock came last year, so the wow is now getting a little stale. And let me just put this drop in context. There was a rise between 85 and the early 90s, and that was the crack period that the chief mentioned. There was about a 40% drop, over a 40% drop in murder and robbery between, say, 93 and 2000, and the nation as a whole was very flat, up 1 or 2% or down 1 or 2%, but very flat in those two crimes from 2000 to 2008. Then we had the big drop in 2009, and now we're seeing the big drop in 2010. So the issue is, what's the new drop that we're experiencing? Because the drop in the 40s, I'm sorry, the drop in the 90s was very much driven by aggressive policing, getting guns from people who shouldn't have them, as well as the fading of the crack market, which is what contributed to the rise in the 80s.
Well, let's try
so to... my reaction is something's going on now, and there's a lot of uncertainty about precisely what's doing it. And I think most of us will have a variety of speculations that won't match.
Well, let's drill down into the what might be going on. And Barry Crisberg at the University of California, Berkeley Law School, get us started on that question, because this is where it gets tricky to sort of tease out cause and effect. There is, sounds like, some unanimity about the question of the crack epidemic and the way in which that drove certain kinds of crime in the late 80s. What do we know? What is your sense about what's going on right now? Are you able to determine what is making up this most recent drop that Mr. Bloomstein referred to?
No. And there's two reasons for that. First of all, there's many potential explanations, and I can offer some of my own favorites. But the other thing is, because of its widespread nature, it's hard to pinpoint it. If we were seeing one city up, another city down, one state up, another state down. But it's the broad decline which suggests that maybe we're looking at something you know, more fundamental. But, you know, I would start with what Chief Davis said. We've had a revolution in policing, and that's reflected by in California with a dramatic increase in the number of homicides that police solve. That's a big thing. People report crimes to the police, but actually arresting somebody for a crime is a good sign in terms of the criminal justice system. I think the police solve homicides because citizens help them. And so I think better policing is one factor.
Well, let's stay with that for a moment and try to identify what it is that defines or constitutes better policing. Is it a question of numbers? Is it more cops on the street? Is it the way in which they're trained? Is it precisely focusing on certain crimes and not others? Is it the idea of community policing? You know, what among that sort of general phrase of better policing is it?
I think it's two factors. It is the embrace of most urban police chiefs of a collaborative model with the community. So the police are no longer the occupying army. They're working with communities. They're building relationships. The second thing is the introduction of policing of analysis, crime analysis, targeting. Instead of just seat of the pants anecdotes, more police departments are actually using data and information to target their resources.
Chief Davis, weigh in on that, please, in terms of both the collaborative model that Barry Crisberg describes and the way, ways in which you're using data in different ways.
Yeah, I have to agree with Barry wholeheartedly. And in fact, when I became chief in East Palo Alto, the first hire I made was a crime analyst. And why I did that is that, to me, you have very limited resources. So the strategic deployment of the resources has to be based on intelligence, not guesswork. And what ends up happening, you end up finding out not just that crime is up. And I don't like the guesswork. Well, it's up because gangs are up. We need more information. So you need to identify trends, patterns, get to the root causes of crime. That then gives you the ability to department the community to go after those root causes.
So when you say a crime analyst, can you just give me a specific example of what that individual might be able to pinpoint information then that you would have that you didn't have previously?
Well, for example, intuitively, people may say crime goes up on the weekends. One of the first things I asked the Department of Justice to do when I got here was a 5-year study of homicides in East Palo Alto and found out that Wednesdays was a hot day for homicides. And so being able to then look at how I deploy my resources on Wednesday, if you start looking at you do an analysis of your burglaries, for example, and you may say, well, I need to deploy resources out there. And you go, well, stop, I don't, because the burglaries are going up because people are leaving their windows up. It's hot. So community education may be the greater prevention mechanism, and then you keep your resources where your other hot spots are at with the robberies and the violent crime. So crime analysis really helps you to strategically deploy your resources. But I will say something about these drops, about being consistent. Keep in mind with the statistics, they can be skewed by your major cities, and that you still may have some significant variations within agencies. Because 65% of the reporting might be from a limited amount of agencies, if that makes sense.
Do you mean we're only getting data from some cities and not others?
Well, no. If the majority of the cities don't have homicides, then if you just look in the Bay Area, and you could have 3 or 4 cities that could actually impact 65% of the homicide number and not represent the other 101 cities in the Bay Area. And so you have to put it in context that it's not necessarily just every agency. So, for example, there's a couple of cities that may be experiencing increases last year or even increases this year. And that may skew the number, it may not. So I do agree that nationally it does suggest that something's happening. And I agree that the revolution of policing went from the aggressive policing, which had its also downsides, quite frankly, especially with regards to disparate incarceration rates of young men of color, but now into intelligence-led policing, more partnerships with the community, and really getting into solving problems and using intelligence to really, really focus, and technology, I should say. So, for example, in my agency, we have shot spotters, and that allows me to track gunshots that are not even reported, to identify trends and patterns, hotspot times and days. I have license plate readers where we can scan thousands of license plates in a day to pick up stolen vehicles. So even the increase of technology has helped law enforcement.
Let's talk some as well then about other ways in which particular kinds of services affect crime. Got a good sense of the way in which using particular data helps pinpoint the Wednesday night phenomenon that Chief Davis mentioned, as well as how to deploy resources in particular ways to limit the amount of criminal activity. But what do we know about something that's a little softer, Barry Crisberg, like the amount of social services that are applied or the way in which domestic violence shelters help certain kinds of crimes? Do we know anything about whether or not putting more into social services, which also happened in the 90s, has had a consequence in terms of crime?
I think there's strong evidence pointing in that direction in two important ways. We invested really starting during Bill Clinton's administration major resources in reducing violence against women and reducing violence against children. And those rates are down substantially. And so we know from a lot of research that children who are witnesses or victims of violence tend to reproduce that violence. So I think you've got a cohort of youth where a smaller percentage of them have been subject to violence. The second thing is we know early childhood programs, support for at-risk families, after-school programs, in a number of individual studies have shown results. Again, we've invested a lot in that. Now, recently, those dollars are being cut back. So I worry a bit for the future. But when you look at the cohort of age 20 to 30 that are contribute disproportionately to violent crime, that was a generation that grew up in a much better time.
Alfred Bloomstein, weigh in on this part of this. Do you concur that those sorts of social investments made during the Clinton era, as Barry Crisberg has described, have made a difference?
There's no question that we have seen effects from greater attention to social investment. There's no question that we've seen effects of more effective policing as the ideas have diffused around the police departments. What's particularly perplexing is the sudden shift from the aggregate having no change to speak of for 8 years to suddenly see an 8% drop followed by like a 9% drop in robberies and 4% in homicides. So it's what happened starting in 2009 that I find an intriguing challenge.
Do you have a theory about that?
And as you think about what happened in 2009, the first thing that happened that comes to mind is the recession. And the recession suggests that things ought to be going worse rather than better. The other hypothesis that I've been mulling for a while is the degree to which one of the very striking events in 2009 was the inauguration of an African-American president. And in murder and robbery, those disproportionately involve African-Americans doing it. And one of the intriguing challenges is finding the degree to which there might be a shift in that.
That's really fascinating. But how do you figure that out? I mean, how do you ever determine cause and effect between who gets inaugurated in January of 2009 and a concomitant drop in crime?
That's an intriguing one. And when I saw the 2009 drop, I looked at arrest data, national arrest data, of African-Americans versus whites. And for murder, whites went up by about 2% and blacks went down by about 2%. In robbery, a similar change, but a smaller change. The blacks went up, blacks went down and whites went up. And even in drug offenses, whites went up and blacks went down. Now, that's a very crude indicator. I'd like to get it much more finely focused on where it might occur. But it's certainly consistent with an Obama effect that could contribute at the margin. But there's a wonderful description by Elijah Anderson of inner city life. He makes it clear that most people who live there are decent people, but then there are the street people. Kids with no future, kids who were high school dropouts, no employment prospect. And to the extent that we might have made just an incremental shift in some of those folks, that there is opportunity, that there is hope in the future, that would be extremely important and is certainly worth pinning down. And, of course, crime is just one indicator. I would think that if there's any such effect, it should show itself in a reduction in school dropout rates and in a variety of other domains where we're seeing a movement to the social norms that we would like to see much more broadly available.
Alfred Bloomstein, criminologist and co-author of Crime Drop in America. I want to get to the question of the role that incarceration plays in all of this in just a moment, because that's a key question too. But I'm very curious, Chief Davis in East Palo Alto, for your take on what Alfred Bloomstein was just seeing, and particularly as you've worked more collaboratively with the community and in your own community of East Palo Alto. I think it's the statistics I saw showed that 90% of the homicides in East Palo Alto are committed by people of color. Are you seeing the connection that he's suggested? Is that even anecdotally something that comes back to you, that there's a difference over the last 2 years?
Well, let me say 90% of my community is of color, so that disparity, so that I can put the disparity in context.
Yep.
And I found the hypothesis extremely intriguing, and so I had to think about that one. I don't know, and I would think that the people that are exacting the violence, and I don't know if they're going to be influenced by the Obama effect. I think it could affect other crimes. It could do the issue of having hope and pride, which is some of the things of why identity, why kids get into gangs. So I think there has to be some effect. I would hope that there would be an effect. But I think the 2009 shift, I think, is something that I'm going to borrow from our Attorney General, Kamala Harris, is being smart on crime and taking on an issue that we have avoided for years. We really started taking it on in 2009, and that is the recidivism rate. You have a small cohort of people that are recidivating at 70%, if not higher, that are responsible for an enormous amount of crime in our communities.
Yeah.
And to the extent that you impact that, and we started finally taking that on as a public safety issue and not a state corrections issue, I think a lot of the second chance contracts from the feds, a lot of the reentry programs, East Palo Alto having one of the model ones there, a lot of things have occurred that has started to go towards this recidivism rate and dealing with the population of parolees, probationers, and first-time offenders that I think may contribute. And like I said, I don't have any empirical data, but I think it will contribute to this shift because it also represented a shift in how law enforcement viewed reentry. As I shared with someone some years ago, when I first got hired in Oakland, reentry meant my job was to put you back in jail.
Yeah.
Very simple. Reentry now is I have to, as a chief, if I have a group that's responsible that has a 70% recidivism rate and I can actually tie them into 5 to 10% of my crime, then not addressing that group is almost a disservice. Now, enforcement.
Let me hold you there, if I might, Chief Davis, because we have to come up on a break, and because this teases into a lot of really interesting areas, including how do you manage to do all this when police staffs are being cut, not only in your city but in all major cities around the Bay Area, and it also brings up this whole question of the prison population. And people have often argued that crime is going down because there are more people in prison, but actually the prison population is dropping. So what does that mean? We'll get into all of that after we return. We'd like to hear your views on this as well. What are you seeing in your community? What are your concerns about crime in particular? How would you like to see police efforts focus? What do you think can be done to continue this drop in crime that we're describing? Here's our number. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the decrease in crime rates. New statistics out this week nationwide, also here in California, show a pretty dramatic drop in crime, not only from 2010 from 2009, but also just generally speaking over the last 20 years, crime rates now is down substantially, which is not to say that crime isn't still a major problem in many cities, of course. We're trying to get at this hour why that's taking place and what more might be done to meet the ongoing challenges. Barry Crisberg joins us. He's Research and Policy Director at the Earl Warren Institute on Law and Social Policy at the University of California, Berkeley Law School. Ronald Davis, Chief of Police for the City of East Palo Alto. And Alfred Bloomstein, criminologist at Carnegie Mellon University, co-author of Crime Drop in America. Lots of emails and calls coming in already. I'm just going to read the first email to you, Barry Crisberg, because I think it gets at this prison question that I wanted to get to. Jim writes in, if crime is down, why are the prisons in California overcrowded?
The prisons in California are overcrowded for two reasons. One is where the vast majority of people entering prison are parole violators. So we're just recirculating the same people over and over again. Of 130 admissions to prison, 130,000, almost 90,000 of them are parole violators. So that's number one. The other thing is because of a variety of laws and voter initiatives, the length of stay of prisoners has gone up. So there's not necessarily more new criminals coming in, but we're keeping them much longer. And if they get released, we're sweeping them back in at much higher rates.
So does that mean then, even if the prison population is not accelerating, even though it feels like that in California because we keep reading about the overcrowded issue, is there a connection between keeping people behind bars and keeping them for longer, like the three strikes law would suggest, that drives down the rate of crime?
There is a very small effect. My colleague Frank Zimmering has estimated the effect of three strikes at about 1%. So certainly there is a tiny effect, but it's not the big effect. I mean, to me, the most dramatic story in California is over the last 10 years, our California youth prisons have dropped from over 10,000 inmates to about 1,000. So 90% drop in people in youth prisons, and youth crime rates have gone down dramatically during the same period of time. Nationally, almost every state is radically reducing its incarceration population for youth, and increasingly states like New York, Florida, and others are reducing their adult prison population. So exactly in this 2009-2010 period that Professor Bloomstein was talking about, incarceration in America is going down, not up.
Alfred Bloomstein, how do you attribute that? What's your read on the fact that as prison incarceration rates go down, crime goes down? That there doesn't seem to be what would seem intuitive, that if you lock more people up, that that's the reason why crime would be going down?
There's a complicated relationship between crime and incarceration. What has been shown, when you think of the different dimensions of the deterrent effect of incarceration, it's the certainty that's the dominant feature, the certainty that you'll be punished, and far less so the severity. And what we've been doing is going up and up in severity, severity indicated by the length of stay. And three strikes, except for taking somebody who is an inherent threat and a continuing threat, makes no sense. So what we ought to have those folks rethink the sentences for the three strikes people. The other issue that I think is particularly important is the degree to which we think that whatever we do, whatever a criminal does, if we lock them up, it'll stop it. Now, when we lock up a rapist, we know that we take his rapes off the street. When we lock up a drug seller, we know that we recruit a replacement for that drug seller. And the concern is that drug offenders are the largest component of prison populations. They're 20% of the state prisons and over 50% of the federal prisons. So that we've got to do a lot of rethinking about what good we do by locking up a particular individual, a group of individuals under different strategies.
This also,
and simply locking away longer is not the best approach. That's been well established. So we've got to do some hard rethinking. And that goes back to the legislature and the way they have reacted with a knee-jerk response when the public says do something. They just do more longer without thinking hard about whether they're doing much good or not.
And let me get your comments, Barry Crisberg, and then we'll get to our calls on this, because this connects up again with three strikes, which has been such a contentious issue in California and speaks to what Alfred Bloomstein was saying about voters and legislation. Because it brings us back to the resource question that you mentioned earlier. Do we have an idea about what it costs, what three strikes cost? Because depending on the answer to that question, I would think it would also raise questions then about whether or not it makes sense, just from a safety standpoint, to spend money that way versus some of the other ways we were talking about, whether that's increasing the way in which the resources that police have or social programs.
A typical three striker who gets a life sentence is going to cost the taxpayers $1.5 million at least, and it could go up because of the average cost and that extended over time. Now, if we're talking about a very dangerous person, I think we'd all agree it's worth the price. The problem is a very large percentage of the three strikers don't look like that. They're basically low-level offenders who have gotten caught up in the system and because of some prosecutors get put in. So I'd say if you're talking about a multiple property offender or somebody who steals television sets, I don't want to spend $1.5 million to lock that person up.
You'd rather see that money go to Chief Davis to have more resources or more social programs?
Absolutely. And I think increasingly there's a growing opinion that we need to reduce our expenses on incarceration. We've spent a phenomenal amount of money on incarceration and redirect that money to police. It makes no sense to have fewer police in our communities but have a Cadillac prison system.
Let's hear what our listeners are thinking about on this subject this morning. We'll go to John first in San Francisco. John, go ahead, please.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
There's
go ahead.
There's one aspect of this drop in crime rate that's not usually discussed, but the fact that most everybody has a cell phone these days must have some kind of impact. There's so many people able and willing and ready to drop that dime as soon as a crime occurs. I think it'd be interesting if there's a study to track and correlate cell phone usage and the drop in crime rate in particular areas.
John, thanks. Interesting question. Any of our guests want to weigh in on the cell phone factor? Chief Davis?
Yeah, I'll weigh in. And in part, for certain crimes, I think the accessibility of the community to the police has helped a lot. And you have communities that the more engaged they are, then they'll help. In crimes of violence where they say they're gang-related, it doesn't help in a sense because the reluctance of witnesses is usually based on fear of retaliation, and that doesn't change because of the cell phone. But I think you're right, and so police departments have to engage that. So we have anonymous text tip lines, websites, Facebook pages, Twitter. And so the idea is that there's now all of these social media ways that people talk. And so the more law enforcement engages with that, then the more information we're likely to get. So I agree with John, the caller, that probably has had an effect. I don't think it's been measured. I'll turn to my academic partners, but I think intuitively it should have an effect.
Let's hear next from Brian in Palo Alto. Brian, go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. John actually came close to my point, but my point is that an underlying effect on many of the reductions is probably self-esteem. And if you look at the Obama effect in that way, you can see that it improves self-esteem. And so the other thing that can do that is connectedness. And so I think the internet and the explosion in smartphones that allow people to connect with each other on just by, you know, Twitter and Facebook and texting and all that stuff, it improves people's feeling of connectedness and their self-esteem, and that alone can have can affect their decisions about whether they're going to commit a crime or not.
Brian, thanks. Thanks for the observation. I have to say, Barry Crisberg, I never thought we'd have a discussion about crime rates that would involve Twitter. Is that something we need to look at? There's all these sort of fascinating ideas that people have about what might be going on.
Well, I do agree with the caller's comment that connectedness is very important. Some of the best research we have suggests that in communities where there's a lot of social interaction, community life, crime rates will be lower than communities that are as poor and as troubled, but where people are kind of stuck away in their public housing projects. So there's no question that that social interaction and the recreation of community by whatever means is a positive
thing. Do you have a Twitter account, Chief Davis?
Yes, I do. We have a Facebook page, and I'm at Twitter at EPA Chief. So it's just fine that there's a good way of providing information to the community. And if I can add this thing about the self-esteem, I think the research shows, and we see it firsthand in the field, you know, the question of why people get into certain, especially with gangs and violence, and it really is a lack of identity. And so a lot of that is a new generation that doesn't know their own past, their own culture, and they're looking for something to identify. So it gets into the issue of dysfunctional homes. So anything that improves that connectivity, anything that connects them to something. And if we don't provide it, then usually the gang provides everything that they're looking for, a family, a unit, an identity. It's just a very negative one and very destructive one. So when I look at the reinvestment of resources, then that's where the resources should be reinvested in getting into some of these dysfunctional homes, getting to where people have role models. And so maybe that's where the Obama effect comes in. But, right now I think that's going to be one of the key things for the future crime rate, if you will.
Ronald Davis, Chief of Police for the City of East Palo Alto. We'll move on to John in Sonoma. John, go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm just reading a great book called Freakonomics, which I don't know if these gentlemen have read about or if they agree with the statistics behind it. But it talks more about a longitudinal statistic where, for example, Roe versus Wade had an effect on the crime rate drop, but it took 20 years to see the effect because the children, you know, that were more likely to become criminals now weren't being born. Could you have the gentleman just respond to that if they've read the book or if they can help me recognize it or discount it for what
yeah,
it is?
Yeah, John, it's an interesting theory. It got a lot of attention when that book came out. Barry Crisberg on that, please.
Yes, I'm familiar with the book, and I can tell you that many top-flight academic criminologists have looked at it, and it's absolutely untrue. There is no data to support it. It's fast and loose statistics.
Alfred Blumstein?
Let me say that there was a major estimate in the original work by Steve Levitt and John Donahue that gave rise to an estimate that roughly half of the crime drop was attributable to Roe v. Wade. First, I should point out that the initial recipients of the Roe v. Wade decision are now in their 30s, which is when crime rates are much lower. So that certainly would not be attributable to the current crime drop. During the crime drop of the 90s, they took no account in their analyses of the changes in the crack markets. And a number of other people have taken the same data and found no effect of the Roe v. Wade decision, and the Roe v. Wade and the analyses didn't take account of abortions that might have occurred before Roe v. Wade, when there was certainly a regular market, nor did it take account of contraception that avoided unwanted children, which is the major thrust of the basic results.
It's an interesting example of how I think this is so complicated and how difficult it is, because you can't really run a controlled experiment on these things. It's hard to have a sort of randomized experiment within cities about what's causing what. Barry Crisberg.
Absolutely. Oh. And it's almost certainly the case that there's no single fact. Once the word of the crime drop came out, I got a variety of emails saying that it was transcendental meditation that caused it. It was the availability of guns that caused it. Availability of guns as a deterrent to commit crimes. The less lead in the water. And all of these could well be contributing a small amount, but it's very tough to find a single effect that is a dominant one.
Yeah.
Can I put one thing out there?
That explains it all.
Yeah, Chief Davis, go ahead, and then we'll get back to our calls.
It's interesting. One of the things that I think has contributed is what you have on the show today, and I think Barry can speak to this because, for example, My department has partnered with UC Berkeley and his center at least twice on projects. I think now the connectivity of the connection between practitioners in the field and academia has also advanced policing to be more evidence-based and to be more strategic and more successful. Years ago, you would never have the two really come together. They may even be at odds about the causal factors of crime and any success rates. But you're seeing more and more that, as a police chief, I rely heavily on the research that these gentlemen are doing and the other researchers, men and women, are doing in the field. And we partner quite often. And a lot of the grants require such a partnership so that we're investing scarce dollars into very evidence-based practices. And so I think that has part of that evolutionary process for law enforcement. I don't know if my colleagues agree.
Barry Crisberg, do you see that as another example? We were talking earlier about connectivity. Chief Davis is saying there needs to be connections and collaboration, not just within the community, but to academic resources as well.
I think that's helpful. I do want to throw another thing into the hopper here, which I think is a big yet to be examined issue, is that the effect of immigration on reducing crime. Even though I guess in the popular media people would assume that immigration means more crime, every single credible study has shown that an increase in immigrants is associated with a significant decrease in crime.
It's interesting. There's a new Brookings Institution report out this week that looked at, among other things, at what's going on in the suburbs. Here's just a brief quote from their report, which is, as the share of poor, minority, and foreign-born suburbanites grows, suburban crime goes down. So it seems like those sorts of, again, these intuitive things we think about just aren't true.
Well, I think that's right. Now, again, in the case of immigration, we've had consistent findings in many states over the years, and so that's pretty steady. I think the significance of the Brookings study is that 20 years ago, William Julius Wilson talked about the impact of compacted poverty on violent crime rates. Conscious social policies have moved people out of the housing projects into the suburbs, into other communities. We've been trying to move away from the Cabrini-Green phenomenon. And so I think this Brookings study suggests that those policies have worked, that to some extent, and that to the extent that we're not putting all the most at-risk people in one tightly circumscribed area is probably helping crime rates.
And let's go next to Larry, who's joining us on the satellite network this morning from Raleigh, North Carolina. Larry, go ahead, please.
Yes. My question for your callers is whether or not there's been any research done on any correlations between the change in the American demographic and the drop in this crime rate. I mean, clearly, we as a country are getting older. There are less people, for example, contributing to Social Security and to Medicare and so forth. So clearly, we're getting older, and if a large percentage of the perpetrators are young, unproductive males, then maybe that has something to do more so with the crime rate than something that we're actively doing.
Larry, thanks. Interesting question. By way of answering it, let's bring in Chris Magnus, who is chief of police in Richmond, California. I apologize, chief, for getting to you so late in our program, but thank you very much for joining us. Do you have a thought on what Larry just raised in terms of the changing population? Does the graying of America contribute to the reduction in crime that we're seeing?
Well, I think it's no secret that as folks get older, the likelihood that they're going to be involved in violent crime or really any kind of crime goes down. That's why, one of the decisions even made in terms of reducing prison population ought to be based on age of offenders and the likelihood of reoffending, as somebody gets older. But changing demographics certainly do play into crime, and I think we're seeing that in a lot of cities.
Richmond is still a city where crime is obviously still a significant problem, even though we're seeing declines everywhere. That's not to suggest that crime isn't still an issue, as it is, I know, in Richmond. How are you trying to marshal limited resources? Chief Davis was talking earlier about his focus on using data to pinpoint Wednesday night, for example, as a night when he needs to have his department particularly focused on certain things. In this era of diminished resources, how are you trying to go about that job in Richmond?
Well, Chief Davis and I are really on exactly the same page, and we're doing many, many of the same things. We are, you know, we found here in Richmond that we don't always mirror what's happening nationally. Sometimes crime goes up or down, and Richmond continues to be stuck in a very difficult position due to a lot of entrenched poverty and other factors that have affected this community for decades. But we really are seeing some positive changes now, and that's happening, I think, for a number of reasons. The biggest one, I believe, is not even so much data-driven as it is relationship-driven. We have a community policing philosophy and practice at place in our community that really demands that all of our personnel are community policing officers. This isn't, there's not just a team of problem-solving officers or a small group of people who are identified as community policing specialists. The expectation is that all of our officers are going to function in that way. And we assign them to specific neighborhoods where we expect that they're going to get to know the residences, the businesses, the schools, the community groups. We want them to know both the good folks and the problem people on their beat. And then there is a real expectation that we're not just going to be reactive. We're going to be proactive in terms of going out there and addressing not only crime problems, but quality of life issues that are going on the beats. And then we use a system, much like is done in a number of other cities, called CompStat, where we bring people together on a regular basis to track, you know, really where and when crime's happening. It's an opportunity to brainstorm about what works. We bring in community people to be part of those discussions. And we really engage other governmental units, community groups, and residents in this, because I think one of the biggest things we have to get away from is the idea that the crime problem is a police problem in and of itself. It really is a community problem, and therefore, to solve it, we're going to have an active and engaged community. And the only way to accomplish that is for people to see the police as a legitimate partner.
Right.
And that's really the direction that we've been heading. And the results are extremely positive.
Chris Magnus, Chief of Police in the city of Richmond, California. We just have a few minutes left. I want to try to get in a few more calls and emails because this, again, speaks to this question of resources. This is an email from Heather, who writes in from Vallejo. Crime in my Vallejo neighborhood is up. My neighborhood went from a nice middle-class neighborhood to one that has to deal with prostitutes, drugs, break-ins, and there aren't any police. I can't sell the house because it's underwater, so forth and so on. There are these communities, obviously, that are still really struggling, Barry Crisberg. Vallejo, as we all know, is a city that's had terrible times with supporting city services, went through bankruptcy. Where does that bring us back to as far as, again, in this difficult economic climate we're in, where we're perennially talking about cutting budgets? We've heard both Chief Magnus and Chief Davis talking about what they need. Where does that leave you in terms of the kinds of resources we most need in a place like Vallejo?
Well, this is why I think that Governor Brown's going in the right direction, providing the resources back down to the local level, having decisions made in the county and city settings where citizens can really weigh in on what the needs are, as opposed to resource allocations made in Sacramento by a legislature that's often influenced more by interest groups than what really is going on in communities.
Let's take one more caller. Mona joins us in San Jose. Mona, go ahead.
Hi, yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I just have three comments. I've been in the early child care industry for 22 years. I want to say that when you close a preschool and you close preschools right and left, the same with kindergarten and early education programs and after school programs, you're asking for trouble. And, you know, it just causes more dysfunction. And I read in the newspaper and heard yesterday on the news that Sacramento accidentally released 450 inmates at high risk and violence accidentally released them back into the community, parolees. And they were not required to report to a parole officer, and I understand that parole officers are being laid off. My father was in the sheriff's department for 34 years.
I'm sorry to interject, Mona, but we're short on time, and you've raised an important point, and I want to try to get some response to that. So thanks for raising that question. Barry Crisper, can you respond to that concern about both the accidental release, which was reported this week, but Mona's other point about again, where we're cutting and where our priorities need to be? Do we need to focus more on parole officers to get at the recidivism problem that Chief Davis talked about earlier?
I think the story she referred to is not correct, and has actually been sort of hyped by some people. It is not the case that people have been accidentally released by any stretch. But on the other hand, investing in the front end, early childhood programs for at-risk children, healthcare needs, is a much wiser investment. Every study we know suggests that waiting till the back end of the system and investing in parole is really wasteful. The RAND Corporation years ago showed us that prevention investments produce a tenfold increase over anything we're going to put into the prison system.
And what do we have to be wary of now that the Supreme Court has ordered additional release or reduction in terms of California's overcrowded prison situation?
I would say we really don't have to worry because if done properly, no dangerous people will be released. And in fact, all we're going to do is adopt policies that Governor Wilson, Governor Duke Machen, Governor Ronald Reagan have introduced over the years. This is fear-mongering, and it's fear-mongering mostly by people who have an interest in what I would call the correctional industrial establishment.
We'll have to leave it there. I'm sorry that we don't have more time to get in some last thoughts from Chief Davis, Alfred Bloomstein, Chief Magnus as well. It's a fascinating topic, interesting comments from all of you. I thank all of you for participating in our program today. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Kevin Guillory, Tina Lorberg, and Christina Russo. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Again, our guest this hour, Barry Crisper from the UC Berkeley Law School, Ron Davis, Chief of Police in the city of East Palo Alto, Chris Magnus, Chief of Police in Richmond, and Alfred Bloomstein, criminologist at Carnegie Mellon University, co-author of Crime Drop in America. Thanks again, all of you, for contributing your views to our program this morning. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.